This is Dave Mitchell for Radioactive Magazine on KKFI. Today we are again talking with Ms. Pythia Pei, award-winning author of America on the Couch, Psychological Perspectives on American Politics and Culture. In her book, Ms. Pei shares numerous interviews she has had with primarily Jungian analysts on our American psyche. Discussions include the primary myths that are preeminent for our nation, the collective wounds we have suffered, and the shadow aspects of our collective myths and how they manifest. We spoke with Ms. Pei last week, and we definitely were not finished with our discussion. Circumstances allowed us to schedule Ms. Pei for this week's Radioactive Magazine. So, Ms. Pei, we very much appreciate you joining our show again so soon.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay. I enjoyed our last conversation, and I look forward to this one today.
Yeah, it was a very enjoyable discussion last week, and I definitely had the feeling that we sort of were barely had started. So, near the end of our talk last week, we had begun to talk about your interview with James Hillman, a Jungian analyst, and his observation that America is in the process of having a breakdown. And he agreed with your observations that powerful myths which have shaped America, mainly our monotheistic religions, our secularism, and our economic myths, have peaked and are in their decay. What effects do you think these decaying myths are having on our American psyche?
Well, I think when you, these three things, religion, science and humanism, and economics, represent three major cultural containers that are common to all nations and that function to hold a society together. So when these three things begin to fray and come apart, it can be a very dangerous time psychologically, as people can't rely on the stability of these institutions to support them anymore, and a kind of free-floating anxiety and a kind of chaos pervades the psychic atmosphere that people can't quite put their finger on. And I think on an individual basis, I think a lot of people can look at these three areas of their lives, and they can see how, I think, beginning with the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, these areas have radically shifted over their lifetimes. And I think if we start with our monotheistic Judeo-Christian faith, for example, and even if you're not a Christian, this Judeo-Christian faith has been fundamental to our shared Western cultural heritage, which goes, our story goes all the way back to the first Puritans, who were the religious outcasts from England, who fled to this country seeking their Eden, their heaven on earth, or their city on the hill, which was first established in Boston. So it was their experience of religious persecution that led to our country's foundation in the right to religious freedom. So I think that we're still a very religious country. We have one of the highest rates of religious belief of any country in the world. But it's a very diffuse, diverse, mobile kind of religious faith that has dramatically shifted over the course of my lifetime. Like a lot of people, I grew up going to church on Sunday, for instance, but after I left home, I left the church and I embarked on my own spiritual search. So like many people, the faith of my childhood didn't carry over into my adult life. So I think that's one way in which faith is the underpinning isn't as stable as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot more people that sort of take a spiritual approach and not any kind of official religion.
Right, and I think that, yes, the religion that they might have been raised with, or maybe it didn't satisfy them in a spiritual sense. It was maybe more a conventional form of religion, maybe too dogmatic, and was less based in actual experience of the sacred and the spiritual. I think a lot of people began to really hunger and yearn for that, and not have religion be something that defined them in terms of morality or dogma. So I think that's been Well, I think that's been a very positive thing, and it's been kind of a, I think of it sometimes as a, we talk about liberation movements. I really think that beginning in the 60s, something like a religious liberation movement started to happen, mm-hmm. where you didn't have to stay in the religion that you were born into. And that, I think that's part of our, I think it traces its roots back to that original story of the Puritans fleeing oppression and wanting the freedom to worship in their own way.
Mm-hmm. But isn't this loss of orthodox religions, it's not just typical of the United States, but isn't that sort of a general problem in industrialized society?
I think it is, and it's interesting because when you hear discussions about this, I mean, for instance, you'd look at Europe, which is a very secular country, and they don't have the same high church going rates that we have in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think Hillman's referring to the kind of erosion of this myth but the Judeo-Christian faith. I think he's talking about it in the way it's actually changed shape in our time, or the multiplication and the diversification of it,
mm-hmm.
so that there's a kind of, there are so many different faiths that one can choose from now, mm-hmm. and maybe that's a good thing, but also maybe that has weakened something that people used to count on. It's not the faith of, as I said, it's not the faith of my childhood.
Well, I think there's also the issue that that America has turned quite materialistic,
mm-hmm.
and that we love, or at least I think there's the issue of money, the sort of love of money in our culture.
Yes, there is a love of money in our culture, and I think it's also one of those things. I think when Hillman talks about the erosion of these myths that are beginning to fray and come apart, and he said that as they begin to fray and come apart, they become intensified as a kind of defense of against what's really happening. So I think you can see that with money. And money has always been a part of our culture, but what we're seeing right now is this great economic disparity that's taking place, so that the economic myth in our country, nothing has been more fundamental to our identity than these principles of economic self-sufficiency and autonomy. And so that also goes way back to our roots, because, we were formed, the revolution began because of we were being unfairly targeted or taxed by the mighty British Empire. And so we came together, the founders came together, and they brilliantly articulated economic principles of fairness and justice, so that the unchecked power of monarchy and aristocracy on the part of the British Empire against those less materially well off, wouldn't be repeated in the New World. So during the Constitutional Convention, they constructed this entire social order that allowed each person to manifest those skills given to them, by at the same time being protected by what they called these bestial forces that dominated human nature, and that if unchecked would lead to inequality. And I think we see this background in two really popular myths that we're all familiar with. One is the belief that no matter how poor or humble your background, anybody born in America can make it if they just work hard enough. The
right.
kind of Horatio Alger, haul yourself up by the bootstraps idea, the myth. you know, anybody can make it in America.
And that particular myth is fading. Is that
well? That's gone. Actually factually not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, statistically now, if you're born into poor circumstances, you are facing very great odds in becoming successful in the way we think of America and the way we think of American material success, owning a home, raising a family. There's a lot of economic uncertainty now that's making that a very, very difficult American dream to realize.
Okay. So what is...
And a lot of this, we see this in the whole debate now that's going on around the 1% and the 99%.
Right.
So that the great unfairness that we saw, that we felt was perpetrated against us by the British Empire, is now being perpetrated against the people, some say, by these large corporations.
Uh-huh. So this has to have a powerful effect on if large numbers of people recognize this and feel this, then there has to be a very profound effect on our society collectively that this is no longer true, or true only for a few exceptions.
I think so. I mean, you know, myths are very powerful forces, and when a myth dies, it's like a kind of psychological earthquake. And I think that the effects of the erosion of these economic myths, which have historically defined us as a people and which has drawn people from around the world to come here looking for a new and a better life, so it is practically written into our cultural DNA, are beginning to now be seen. We spoke last time about the rise in suicides for white men. And recently, new statistics have come out about the rise in suicides for women between the ages of 35 and 64. And I think we can, and I, who knows if this is playing a part, if the erosion of our economic myths are playing a role in this, but they're happening kind of parallel to each other. And I think we can see the erosion of our economic myths in certain geographical sections of the country that have lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. And you see in these areas a troubling rise in addiction and overdoses on prescription painkillers like OxyContin and oxycodone. And I think it's probably not an accident that the word painkiller is linked to these drugs, because even though they're prescribed initially to treat physical pain, a lot of people are turning to them to relieve psychic suffering and psychological suffering.
So there's a lot of depression and despair and going on underneath the surface. I know that in your interview with Murray Stein, he said that he noted that America's feeling of insecurity or security is very weak right now, and that these feelings of insecurity lead to defense mechanisms and projection. And can you talk about how those defense mechanisms and projections are manifesting in America and how powerful they are?
Well, I think one place that we can see this, and we see this obviously reflected in the Donald Trump campaign, is the fears that are being generated around immigration right now. And I think this, Hillman said that, I said that we feel these things shifting, the ground is kind of shifting beneath us, and that things aren't the same anymore. And Hillman said that these feelings, these fears manifest as a fear of immigrants and of our borders being transgressed.
Right.
And so I think that, in a way, I think that America's basis as a country of immigrants is a kind of daring thing, because it's always been a kind of natural human response that when individuals feel threatened or insecure, they tend to deal with it by projecting their fears and even maybe their own self-hatred or their own disgust or at themselves as a kind of failure. And they project that onto the other. or the foreigner. So the stranger has always been a kind of convenient target of projection, and I think that that's a real possibility or kind of weakness in the American psyche. And it's kind of an unconscious shadow side of our great ideal that we hold out of being a land that welcomes immigrants, as we see that ideal embodied in the majestic Statue of Liberty. But it's also been a part of our history that with every wave of new immigrants, whether the Irish or the Italians or the Asian Americans, we've gone through a kind of convulsive period of rejection and then acceptance. But I think a reanimation of immigration as an expression of the soul of our country, kind of an education around that, would be a wonderful idea if we could find out a way to do that, to get that out into the culture. But in talking about immigration also from a psychological perspective and in kind of wanting or sensing that there's a need to understand the psychological dynamics of immigration and the dangers inherent in that, I think that the political debate and the xenophobia around immigration and that we're seeing currently today is also a defense that keeps us from feeling all the neglected emotions that we have as individuals surrounding our own immigration stories, and that we tend to, depending on how long our family roots, how deep our family roots go in this country, over time we tend not to address that, and all these feelings fall on the cutting room floor, because we all have a story somewhere in our background of leaving the old country for the new. And with that departure, there were the feelings of the loss of culture, of food and religion and family traditions and language. And so the deeper this ancestral past, the more these memories get buried. And so while we celebrate the courage and initiative of the immigrant, we forget the kind of complicated psychological parts around it. And one of the things I learned from James Hillman, from another psychoanalyst I interviewed, was that the sight of new immigrants arriving with all their customs and their heritage intact stirs in those of us whose families have lived in this country for several generations a kind of envy for what we've lost and for recovering, a kind of desire and a nostalgia and a yearning for recovering our own roots. And as I learned from another Jungian analyst recently, the kinds of walls that Trump is referring to, and which have a kind of long history in human experience, when you look at, for instance, the Great Wall of China, or Hadrian's Wall that was built by the Roman Empire to keep out barbarians. Uh-huh. So fear of immigrants and the idea of building a wall, these are not new. These are ancient struggles in the human experience, and I think that Donald Trump is kind of using or misusing to his own benefit. I think sometimes we build walls, or we toy with this idea of building a wall to keep out immigrants, because on a psychological level, it's another way to construct walls around our own feelings of keeping out all the nostalgia and the mourning and the loss of around our own ancestral connections.
But it's also a way of isn't it also a displacement or a way of not dealing with your own feelings, the current feelings around what we were talking about before, you know, the depression and despair around economic loss, not being able to, feeling it like you can't get ahead, those feelings. So there's a displacement going on there as well.
Onto the newly arriving immigrants, you mean.
Right. Isn't that, at least that's my thought right at this moment.
Well, no, I think that's true. And I think that also the immigrants, I mean, this is just my speculation, I think there must be a kind of constellation of reasons for why we have this fear right now of immigrants and this xenophobia that we're experiencing. But I think in another way, for those of us, for those who are suffering the loss of the American dream, to see immigrants newly arriving with all their hopes and their ideals, and maybe even some of those new immigrants arriving with, say, better skills than the people mm-hmm. who've been here, who are suffering now right. from suffering economically and don't have a job. They've lost their job. Maybe their home has gone into foreclosure, and then they see the arrival of new immigrants, and maybe these new immigrants have the skills that they're lacking. So these new immigrants get the better jobs and have the higher incomes. And not only that, they're coming fresh with their intact culture. So there's a lot of loss, I think, that can be triggered around the whole idea of the immigrant, quote unquote.
Right. But behind all this, I think, is the structural issues of our vast inequality and inequality going on right now. I think that's a background to all this. I think, there is the Donald Trump campaign. There appear to be powerful forces involved with supporters of the Donald Trump campaign. You know, they, including their willingness to give him a pass on a wide variety of very inappropriate comments. What feedback do you have on this observation?
Well, when I hear Donald Trump make these pejorative comments against women, and his inappropriate comments on abortion. I think when you look at the crowds and the crowds that attend his speeches and the way they respond to that so positively, I think that he gets away with it and is kind of given a pass on it, obviously because he gets voters that way. And, you know, so that's bringing people, as they keep saying, he keeps bringing people into the Republican Party who have been disenfranchised, who haven't belonged to the Republican Party before. And I think it all plays into these dramatic cultural shifts that are happening. And so that a certain segment of the population is reverting back to some of the old prejudices, almost like naughty children who are saying things that they know you shouldn't say in school or you know you shouldn't say to someone, but you go ahead and say it anyway, and, oh, it's okay to say, and everybody kind of sniggers and laughs at racist comments because racism is kind of then condoned, or anti-immigrant remarks, you know, So these things are condoned, I think, and they're accepted because they know that they're bringing in these voters who still have these prejudices and these perspectives.
But yeah, there's something about the feelings that Trump evokes and the voters that support him. I mean, you know, what do you think it is about him? In a number of ways, he does embody the American hero myth, does he not? I mean, by being a successful businessman and theoretically, and a successful entrepreneur, there's something about him that strikes some very deep chords in the people that support him.
Well, I think that might be a kind of wealth by identification going on with Trump, because I think many of his followers are not wealthy. They're maybe middle income or even lower income. Mm-hmm. And I think that so they feel wealthy and they feel powerful by identification. And I think that they feel that they will get some of what he has if he's elected as president. And as he's promising to deliver by changing these trade policies, which I actually happen to agree with, I think Bernie Sanders also is also addressing these trade policies that we have. But so I think there's something about him. He's a strong man. He's powerful. He speaks very simply. He says very simple things. So he's easy to grasp, and yet underneath, I think that he's very smart in some ways about what he's been doing. In fact, I think he's even admitted recently in some interviews that that he was going to stop saying some of the things that he was saying, that it was part of his plan or a program that he'd had all along.
Right, he's going to rehabilitate his image.
Right. So that... Now he'd use that to great effect to kind of build momentum, and now he was going to have to pivot in order to win over voters from the mainstream.
Right.
I mean, the businessman, I mean, America loves a successful businessman. I mean, we all love that that TV show called Shark Tank, which is a very popular show about people who, entrepreneurs who come in with ideas and they get funded if they're successful. We all love that successful, self-made person story. And even though Donald Trump wasn't self-made and he inherited money from his family, I think he still comes across. I think people still see him as the embodiment of the self-made entrepreneur.
Right. Well, Ms. Pei, I'm getting the signal here that we need to wrap up for today.
Okay.
We will be talking with you again for our May 31st show. And so people can mark their calendars if they like hearing this show and the one last week. So, thank you very much for talking with us and on here in Radioactive Magazine. And and we look forward to talking with you for the May 31st show.
Wonderful. I look forward to that, too.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Bill Claus with Radioactive Magazine. Here's a community event that you might be interested in. On Thursday, May the 19th at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch, 4801 Main, the American Friends Service Committee, along with the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council and the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, will hold an interfaith forum exploring the wisdom of faith to confront extremist violence, the refugee crisis, and fear. The goal of this forum will be to explore how our core belief systems and faith values can provide guidance for U.S. policy and action. That's Thursday, May the 19th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the KC Public Library's Plaza Branch, 4801 Main. Now, please stay tuned for Counterspin after these messages.
On Monday, May 2nd at 7 p.m., 350 KC, we'll be hosting the film Disobedience at All Souls Unitarian Church at 4501 Walnut, Kansas City. This film is part of a national effort by 350.org to inspire participation in their Break Free from Fossil Fuels campaign in mid-May. May 2nd, 7 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Church.